A monthly podcast on the spoken word, episode number 89, June 2025. Voice coaching, sound design, and amplification in the theatre. A conversation with Sarah Nichols. Hello, Paul Meyer here. Welcome back. Lots of correspondence following our last episode on AI and the human voice. Thanks, Mark Dallas, one of IDEA's associate editors, for your comments. Mark was interviewed by Jackson Weaver of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation on the use of AI in The Brutalist. Guess that accent. Last time I played this clip from the IDEA archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
People from South have a real thick accent. I would probably have a problem hearing what they're saying. And I think there's actually, fairly big differences in the accents, and you don't have to travel that far to experience a new dialect. So you can travel fairly short distance, like a 12 drive, and you would experience a fairly good difference.
Your guess? If you picked Sweden, congratulations. It was IDEA's Sweden 2. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then Europe, then Sweden. The subject, who had been attending college for just a month before Associate Editor Joseph Papke interviewed him in 2006, is from Gothenburg. Thanks again, Joseph. Now, this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend his formative years?
When I was a little kid, I had 6 years old when we got the satellite dish, and I started watching foreign programs. I watched Cartoon Network, and I watched the same cartoons as I watched on our television programs in our language that were synchronized.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. If you're not listening to me right now on paulmeyer.com, that's the best source. Why not switch over now? Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab and then click episode number 89. We have some extras there for you, not available on any other podcast channel. My guest this month is Sarah Nichols, one of our most prolific senior editors of IDEA. We've used several of her IDEA recordings as the subject of our Guess That Accent quiz. Cameron Meyer, our co-producer, joins me today. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So this is all about the use of microphones in the theatre, the amplification of the actors' voices. And your wonderful article in the Voice and Speech Review prompted this podcast episode. The article, Bridging the Gap Between Voice Coaches and Sound Designers in the Theatre, which you published in the Voice and Speech Review in 2022. You may be the first scholar to point out the lack of dialogue between the two specialists, the voice coach and the sound designer. I think your article is hugely important. Why was writing it so important to you, and what impelled you to this research?
Thank you. And yeah, it's actually shocking to me that I might be one of the first, because it seems so straightforward. As a performer, where this started for me was when I was working on cruise ships. I had a contract where I was sort of in charge of the other singers in my cast, and I had to run sound checks. So it was the singers, the band, and then the sound designer in the booth, and I was in charge of running those sound checks. And I'd never done anything like that in my life, and so I had no idea where to begin. And I felt frustrated with that lack of knowledge. I feel like I should know more about this right now, being in charge of a sound check. So that's where the frustration began.
So as a voice coach, you felt lacking the vocabulary of a sound designer, right?
I did. And this was reinforced when I first started going to Central School in London. There was a conference there that fall that I attended. And at the end of the conference, there was a big open discussion about this very topic, about microphones. Do we need them? Are they here to stay? And the room was split down the middle. Half of the room was very adamant. They were kind of purists, like, no, absolutely not. Microphones, they detract from the pure theater experience, and we shouldn't have them at all. And then the other half of the room was very much, they're here to stay. There's nothing we can do about it. So how do we navigate it? And in that moment, it really dawned on me that I think where the tension in that room came from, and I felt very tangible tension, was fear. Fear that our role as a voice coach, specifically, not a dialect coach, but a voice coach in theater traditionally, is in danger.
Yes, I can corroborate that from my experience. I mean, let's kick back and look at this. We've had theater for 2,600 years, and the Greek theaters used to fill, we have thousands of people at Epidaurus and the other amphitheaters, thousands and thousands of years of the development of the acting art. It's been less than 100 years since theaters have been amplifying actors, and it happened in my living memory. If I add my living memory to the living memory of my teachers in the 1960s, between us, my teachers and I remember the absolute ideal of the unamplified, unmediated art of voice and speech in the theatre, when it was the actor who was in total charge of what reached the ears of the listeners. That's what I was trained to do as an actor, and what I've been passing on as in my work as a vocal coach. I can't help grieving over. I'm going to be part of that other half of the room, I think, that you referred to in the central school. I can't help grieving over actors losing that autonomy.
Absolutely. There is a bit of grief because, in addition to losing that autonomy, there's a huge possibility. In fact, it might be actual fact that we have lost the physical, the anatomical capability of being that sensitive to organically resonant sound. So before mechanically amplified music, theater, all of that film, before all of that, right? It was just organically amplified, like you said. And then when people started getting used to things being amplified through machines, we had concerts, we had movies that we went to, and then suddenly the ears not only grew to expect that kind of amplification, the little cilia in our ears broke over time from being exposed to that high of a decibel. So we may not anatomically have the ability to be that
No.
sensitive anymore, and that's part of the grief for me.
I'd never contemplated that aspect, that we actually are organically, physically changed. And that's why part of the reason we our listening habits and abilities are so very different.
Right. It's the expectation for that as an audience member, and it's the expectation of, and I sort of found this out in my research, is the expectation of directors in particular that actors' voices can do things that they physically cannot do because we are so used to amplified sound.
Yeah. I'm going to reference podcast number 34 with Rush Rem. It's All Greek to Me, in which we reviewed this aspect of Greek theatre. There's an idea that I don't want to let go of. I don't know that Rush corroborated me. Did he, Cameron? Did he corroborate the idea that there were bronze vessels filled to varying heights with water, that they resonated sympathetically with the harmonics of the human voice in Greek theatre? Well, do you remember what Rush said about that?
I think our conversation was a bit open-ended. It's awfully hard to confirm details about theater 2,600 years ago if it wasn't specifically written down, and I don't think there is any precise written record of that happening. He didn't dismiss it entirely, though, so it's a really fascinating idea.
Isn't that great?
Ancient technology. Just think about it. People wanted amplification then, so they might have had some form of it.
And I looked up again to confirm for myself the etymology of the word person and the word personality, confirmed that it comes from prosopon, mask. The role of the mask, something sounded through. So your personality is something you sound through. So it's possible. The scholars are divided on this one. I don't know if you've got an opinion about masks having a possible amplifying property like megaphones.
I believe that some of them historically have had that ability.
And I've heard contradictory evidence that actually masks have that muffling effect that you might expect. But anyway. Interesting. So, another aspect of this is where's the sound coming from? I mean, as audience members, we need at least the illusion that it's coming from the actors' mouths, not the loudspeakers over our heads. Cameron, surround sound in the theater. I know you have difficulty with surround sound, but it perhaps even infected the live theater experience too.
Well, I think surround sound, when you're talking about cinema and theater, is somewhat similar. You've got amplification that's coming from places that just aren't natural. Some sound designers and some technicians think that it's automatically a great thing to have sound coming from behind you and beside you, even when your eyes are focused on something that's in front of you. So naturally, mm-hmm. you expect the sound to come from a person on the screen in a movie or a person on a stage in the theater. So I think a lot of the surround sound for film is overdone, or maybe just done badly. Perhaps mm-hmm. it's wise to clarify that if you're in a theater with wonderful surround sound and the mix is great, mm-hmm. then you got no complaints. So perhaps, at least from a cinematic standpoint, it's the bad surround sound that you're noticing. And probably same with the theater. I would say it's much more distracting in the theater because you can see there's a real person up there that you want to connect with. You're looking mm-hmm. straight at that person, and then you've got the sound of that person coming from the side.
Yeah, yeah. I've been to dinner theater where you're sitting in your comfortable little booth at your table with your wine and your hors d'oeuvres, and you can see the actors. You can infer that the actor who's speaking is on the stage, but his voice is coming from a little speaker under your table or above your head. It's crazy. It's crazy.
It's like your food is talking to you.
It's just fascinating. I hadn't really thought of that part about it, surround sound and the direction our eyes are going. Our ears have been facing the same direction, I think, since we were Homo sapiens. And so that's really interesting to think of sound coming from different directions. And what I found in my initial literature review that, and it's an encouraging point, is that what voice coaches want is the same thing that sound designers want mm-hmm. in the theater, which is for the actor's voice to be as full and resonant as possible so that they can do as little amplification as possible. They don't want to have to do surround sound in the theater. They don't want to have to turn up the gain so much on the actor's voice. I think everybody hopefully can agree that they want the audience's experience in the theater to be as organic as possible, as if there were no amplification, but just enough so that the people in the back of the room can hear just as clearly as the people at the front.
And you discovered that to the sound designer discipline and the voice coach discipline, there's no reference in the sound designer literature to the use of the voice coach, hence the title of your wonderful article. The two sides don't talk to each other, right?
Absolutely none that I could find. While there is encouragement of how important vocal training is, at least they recognize how important that is, there is no mention of a voice coach as a way to problem solve or even the existence of one on a production team.
Amazing. Amazing. Back to you, Cameron, as the movie expert on the panel here. Can we blame the movies for killing the art of the unamplified actor in the theater? Do you think it's the movies to blame?
Oh, I don't know. I think if we want to add some perspective to this, we can go back to the late 1920s and early 1930s to talkies, when prior to amplification in the theater, audiences got used to microphones and got used to hearing the sound very clearly all the way in the back row of a theater. Of course, sound wasn't as clear or as high quality back then. It took a while, but I think instantly, if you were in a 2,000-3,000 seat theater.
Movie theater, you're talking
movie
about.
Movie theater, you were, well, any type of theater. When you were seeing a movie in that size theater, you were hearing things more clearly in the back row than you were in a live performance in that same theater, if you get what I'm saying. It's kind of like what Sarah was talking about. Habits changed. Before we go down this road a little bit, Sarah, I would love for you to summarize some more points of your article. As we talked about before, it was in the Voice and Speech Review, and we're not able to share the entire article. Is there anything you want to tell us about your article highlights? Anything that will sort of guide our conversation as we go forward?
For the article, because it's part of the voice and speech review that is available to VASTA members. So if you are a VASTA member,
that's the Voice and Speech Trainers Association. I'm a founder member of VASTA. Sorry, continue.
No, thank you for that. Yes. So if you are a VASTA member, if you are logged on to the website, you can access the Voice and Speech Review through Taylor and Francis. That's the publisher. But the Voice and Speech Review is only available to members of the Voice and Speech Trainers Association, which is why, unfortunately, we can't just post the full article online.
So let's hope we boost recruitment numbers for VASTA.
Yes. I mean, it's an incredible resource. If you are a voice nerd, even if you're a singing teacher, if you are a voice specialist in the medical field, it's really an incredible organization to be part of. And the Voice and Speech Review is a fantastic resource for research that is current and that is pushing the field forward. So I highly recommend, if for nothing else, just to have access to the Voice and Speech Review.
Tara, what was your biggest takeaway from that article, for either for you or for people reading it? What do you want to stress about that experience?
A couple things. One of the biggest things that I want to stress is that moving forward, voice coaches need to be part of the narrative. So for people publishing literature for directors and sound designers in the future, I think it's absolutely imperative for us to somehow get through to them how to use us. Let's start putting a voice coach as a crucial part of the production team from the get-go, so that when these directors and sound designers in training leave training, they know how to employ us. I discovered it wasn't just the relationship between me and the sound designer. It was a key part of how the director knew how to use me or not.
Using you as a voice coach.
Correct, as a voice coach. So there was that. It's just, we are non-existent and we should be existent, especially if we as voice coaches want to continue to be part of this creative process, because we are just as much part of the sonic product of a production as the sound designer is. We equally create a soundscape for a show. I make a few offerings at the end of the article, and one seems pretty straightforward, but really it's just the desire to collaborate. Of course, this collaboration can't happen if people don't want to. So there should be a curiosity, a desire to collaborate with one another. My other offering is, and maybe this is bold for some, but I feel like it would be a strong way forward, is what if always on a production team, there is a sound design team, and that includes the voice coach. So, of course, the sound designer, anybody else who's working, a sound engineer, whoever, you know, works together usually in that realm, and us. Together, we have more pull with the director, where I feel like usually we're brought in at the last minute, and usually we don't have a lot of a say in the show, even though theater is inherently a vocal art form.
Yes.
So that is an offering that I make at the end of the article.
Great. I want to flash back on last month's podcast, AI and the Human Voice. We referenced in that podcast some new AI software, a company called Crisp. Now, if you remember, Crisp has this amazing ability in real time to allow, for instance, Indian call center operators to instantly and in real time transform their Indian English accent into American English. I think that's both amazing and hugely frightening.
That's wild.
And, you know, it got me thinking, now that we were preparing for the interview, the conversation with you, Sarah, if that can be done, can we envisage a time when the sound designer in a theater uses AI to enhance the actor's voices in real time, you know, their final consonants, the clarity of their diction, the muscularity of their diction, as well as their accent, perhaps, so that neither the actor nor the voice coach would be nearly as important? Had you thought of that as a nightmare scenario?
I would hope it wouldn't be a nightmare scenario. And I mean, that's fascinating. And I feel like it would be pretty close around the corner, just to to be more specific about what is amplified, like those final consonants. And I'd be very curious to see how it would work. But I think what would be missing, and this sort of ties back to a thought I had about what you said earlier, Cameron, is there, even if it were to give the actor a lot more clarity than they might be giving, the embodied aspect of that art form is still up to the actor. Even if the microphone's doing a lot of work, if the actor's body isn't fully present, it's still not going to work. And I think part of the effect that film has had on theater, Cameron, is that when naturalism started coming into film, the acting technique changed and it became way smaller, way more intimate. And so actors started to transfer that more intimate technique of acting onto the stage. And that is part of the problem, both vocally and physically. So I think it doesn't even matter how clear a microphone can make an actor if they're not physically in it.
Yes.
If what they're doing with their entire selves is not meeting this venue, it's still not gonna work.
Yes, so the new art form is to create the illusion of cinematic intimacy in live theater in a larger space.
Yes. Do you think as cinema got more intimate in the 1950s, that slowly trickled down to theater, where
yes,
film actors slowly, I shouldn't say lost the ability, but the ability to project in a theatrical way has been lost somewhat over the last few decades in film, and perhaps that's trickled down to theater. So therefore, you need the microphones.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple of productions that you visited or were part of, Shakespeare in Love and Machinal. What did you learn from this field research?
The case study that I talk about in my article was in 2020. I was coaching a production, a college production of Machinal, and I got to collaborate with the sound designer. So it was really just an experiment just to see what might work, what might not work. One of the most exciting moments that I had in that process kind of was a fluke. It was on a dark day, so there was no rehearsal going on. Both the sound designer and I were available, so we met in the theater. And in that show, Machinal, there are soundscapes underneath the dialogue for most of the show, which can be challenging.
What kinds of sounds? Remind us.
Yes. So, for example, in the first scene, it's in an office. So there's papers rustling, there's typewriters clickety-clacketing. So you have all of that basically broadly throughout the entire show. Very mechanical sounds are existing.
And that's part of the theme of the show, of course.
Yes, exactly. It's in the stage notes that they have to be there because they keep reinforcing the machine that the main character finds herself in. So they're very important. And they immerse us into her mind, right? She kind of loses herself through the show. That was really important. And that particular space that we were doing the show in, there were no microphones. And it was an acoustically challenging space because there were a lot of reflective surfaces. So it was hard for the sound to be directed right at the audience. So we were dealing with a lot of challenges there. So on this dark day, what we did was I went down onto the stage. And I'd been working with the actors quite a bit so far. So I was familiar with their voices and knew about at the levels they had been speaking at. So I went onto the stage in different spots where they had some scenes. And I spoke their lines at about the level I thought they were speaking them. Mm-hmm. And at that same time, the sound designer would adjust the levels to his soundscapes for the show to meet the level that I was speaking at. So we worked together really effectively on that dark day. And I interviewed him both before and after this process. And in the second interview afterward, he did say that was really useful for him to have that uninterrupted time with me in this space. So that was an encouraging moment.
What a nice nice collaboration that was.
It really was. Yeah. And again, it was the willingness to collaborate was key. You know, if that sound designer didn't really care to learn about what I needed, then it wouldn't have worked. Right. So that has to be there, of course.
That in turn allowed the soundscapes, those noises, to not be a distraction or an impediment, but an equally contributive thing. So it wasn't that the actor was battling those sound effects. They were working with them, perhaps.
Exactly. And of course, I did my part as well as the voice coach in, I crafted a sort of bespoke vocal warm-up for them that helped them implement the New York dialect that they were already doing as part of the show, while bringing in some chest resonance and some head resonance to kind of balance out those resonances and fill the theater space as best that they could.
Man against machine, man against
Yes,
machine, right?
exactly. And that was, it's, I love that you say that. And it's funny that that the show is mocking all man against machine in a way, because that it felt like that was the challenge I was dealing with in and how the director was regarding me in this space and what I can contribute versus what the sound designer contributed. And that brings me back to that expectation that I think a lot of directors have for actors' voices to do more than they really can. So there was a question of, okay, do we lower the soundscapes or do the actors up the volume? And the director's choice was, nope. Keep the soundscapes as they are. The actors have to be louder. That's not always a doable thing.
Sometimes it's counterproductive, in fact, to be louder.
Exactly. It brought it full circle of, okay, yeah, that's where the expectation of that amplified sound comes in. People think that the human voice can do things that it often cannot physically do in a space, whereas the options that sound designers have are endless and they're quick and they're easily reproducible.
Yeah. Should we jump here and let's review what we know and think about the techniques that actors have used for 2,600 years, i.e., to use an unamplified voice? I've got a list here, and I want you to jump in with what you've learned elsewhere. So, top of the list is great diction, muscular consonants. Consonants carry the meaning of a sentence. And in the larger the space, the more muscular the consonants need to be. Number two, keep up the vocal pressure until the end of each thought, a crescendo effect, because it's the enemy of understanding in the theater, of course, is that familiar dropping away, that dropping off at the ends of thoughts. Number three, don't yell. Stay under the echo threshold, as I call it. If your voice echoes in the auditorium, you talked about working in a very live acoustic space there. If your voice echoes in the auditorium, the echo tends to wash out the specificity of the consonants, right?
Right, and that idea of yelling is interesting, and I love that you are saying don't yell, because that was a note that the director gave the actors at one point with me in the room right before I was going to give my vocal notes to them, and it was just another example of how much directors don't know about the voice and about what we're there to do. So I'm glad that you said don't yell, because no,
Don't
they
yell.
should not be yelling at all. There's ways around that are not yelling.
Mean, yelling is the absolute antithesis of creating intimacy, of course. Yeah. One of my favorites, use a shadow vowel after phrase final consonants. To be or not to be, that is the question. That N at the end of that phrase is such a weak consonant, the audience is liable to hear question. Not hear the final syllable. So just completing and delineating those final consonants, particularly the weak ones. Whether it is nobler in the mind, that D can disappear without the art of the actor. To suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, another weak consonant. Fine in the cinema, we'll hear the N. Even if we don't hear the N, we will infer its presence. Use plenty of variety of jaw and lip movement to increase the visual component. I know you're going to speak to that. So from creed to crude, you've got lip spread to lip round, pack to park, leak to lock. Whereas in cinematic speech, perhaps it's just creed and crude, pack and park, leak and lock, with very little movement of the lips and the jaw. Judicious, artful use of full frontal performance, something that's perhaps gone out of style. And three-quarter profile. I talk about the artful, judicious use of presenting the front of your body to the audience. Audiences don't realize just how much lip reading is involved. And finally, let's not forget how important the eyes are. What's the old saying in musical theater? Eyes and teeth, eyes and teeth. Sort of visual projection.
Yes, in Lessac work, Arthur Lessac's work, which is now called kinesensics, they call it surprise in the eyes. So if the muscles around the eyes and in the face are active, it will inherently make the voice more active as well. It kind of magically happens at the same time. It's very effective.
I mean, we love the close-up in the cinema, don't we? The eyes, seeing the light dance in the actor's eyes as he or she thinks of the next thing to say. So yeah, eyes are the window to the soul, right? Yeah. So this is the kind of tradition that we're talking about. That's, oh my God, is it disappearing entirely, or is this stuff still taught? Do you know?
I would like to think it's still taught. I think a lot of people who are in the Voice and Speech Trainers Association, who are out there training the next generations of actors, I'm quite sure they are still teaching these techniques. I think a lot of where the problem lies is there's not enough theater spaces, and these actors don't get enough time in those theater spaces. So while they are being taught these great techniques, they're in small, dimly lit rehearsal studios with low ceilings. And so they don't actually, their bodies aren't used to being on stages for long periods of time. That was a challenge that I had during this research, and it's common all over the place, especially in academia, where the actors rehearse for most of the production time is in a little studio that's way smaller, has completely different acoustic properties than the actual theater space they will eventually get to, but not until tech, which is a week or two out from the show. So their bodies aren't used to acclimatizing to the space. That's where a lot of the problem lies. Their bodies just don't get enough of that contact time in the space so that they don't understand. They're not given the opportunity for their bodies and their brains to understand that relationship to the
And
space.
yes, hence the panicky director saying, "Yell!"
Yes. Yes, exactly. Well, if you put me in this space weeks ago, then maybe I wouldn't need to yell.
Let's remind ourselves that I challenged you earlier to say when did microphones start being used in the theater. I did a little research, and surprisingly, I found that microphones and amplifications started to be used in live music settings earlier. But then it wasn't until the early 30s that microphones became anything like common. Did you come up with any clarifying knowledge on the history of the use of the microphone?
I did find that the first electronic amplification was in 1906. It was a triode vacuum tube. So it was invented by a man named Lee DeForest. And that was what sort of led to radio shortly thereafter, that kind of amplification. So early 1900s was really the first sign of any kind of electronic amplification that we know of.
And was it used in live theater, or was it for big events, big music events, or what? Do you remember?
I don't know that it was for live events right away. I believe it was for recording music, listening to music in one's home, I think.
Let me jump in here because it's funny. I know the name Lee DeForest, you said, right?
Yes.
I haven't heard that name for a while. I know him because of his experiments with sound on film. As they were trying to develop synchronized sound, he was a part of that effort. So he was obviously a pioneer with sound from the very beginning. So yeah, I find that connection fascinating. But like a lot of things with technology, the invention comes first, and then they're usually several years, sometimes several decades before the practical implementation of that. So if the microphone technology was there in what we say 1906, then I don't think it was used commonly in the theater until several decades later. Am I correct?
My research says 1930s before microphones became common. Microphones for amplifying the actors' voices became common.
And you turned up some interesting facts about the very early days of the invention of microphones. Did you want to point out a couple of those little
Well, yeah,
early moments?
it well, it seems to be in the 1870s when David Edward Hughes, Emile Berliner, and Thomas Edison independently created carbon microphones. 5 or 6 years later, Alexander Graham Bell patented his electromagnetic microphone. Next year, Berliner patented his design, which was based on Bell's idea. And then it sort of jumps, as Sarah has said, to recording studios, the birth of radio drama and radio itself. And then in the 30s, it might become slightly more common to encounter microphones, particularly in big musicals.
And that, again, speaks to the fact that the invention, or at least the pioneering of the technology, happened many, many years before the public saw it. I was struck reading your points about what was happening in the 1870s. I was struck by what else is happening in the 1870s. You have the phone invented in 1876. You have the phonograph in 1877. About 10 years after that, you have movies invented. You had radio being worked on around the turn of the century, even though most people didn't hear the radio until about 1920 after World War I. So it's just fascinating to look at the gap between when the inventors started to do their work and when it was introduced to the public.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can I go back to one thing that you pointed out with close-ups?
Yeah.
I think you were talking about film and how, of course, you can't have a close-up in the theater, but it's fascinating to me that the close-up in film didn't come in until the teens. So that means for about the first 15 years of cinema, there were almost no close-ups and no tracking shots, which of course means that film was influenced by theater.
Right.
And now it's the reverse, starting around 1930 and then more in the 40s and 50s and into today. I would argue that it's film that influences theater.
Yeah, the tail is wagging the dog. If you think of cinema as the tail and the dog as Greek drama, the tail is certainly wagging the dog.
I have a question for you, Sarah. You talk about the lack of communication between the voice coach and the sound designer in theater and sort of the lack of respect. Would we say in our conversation that there's even less respect between the sound designer and the voice coach in film, because there's this sense that everything can be corrected in post-production, whereas in theater, there is no post-production.
Right. That's a great argument to make. And I honestly don't even know how often voice coaches specifically are even on a film set. That you have dialect coaches, of course. You have dialogue coaches, right? Yeah, if there's a particular persona that an actor is embodying, then absolutely both voice and dialect and movement come into play. But honestly, I don't even, every time I watch a movie, I've been doing this for several years now, I look for who's the voice coach or who's the dialect coach. I don't ever see a voice coach
we see
on set.
Look it up on IMDb. You'll never see a voice coach listed, almost never. Dialect coach, very frequently. Of course, I happen to work as a voice coach and dialect coach on movies. I remember one film, which I will not mention, where a very fine actor had a big speech to deliver to a crowd. It was a Civil War movie, and it was a rousing speech that this actor had to deliver. He had only one take in him because at the end of his first take, he had no voice left. He'd blown his voice out. So I wish I'd had the opportunity to work with him prior to that take on how to deliver such an impassioned speech to such a large crowd and be capable of doing more than one take. So that's a place where both the dialect coach and the vocal coach should have been working together. Yeah.
Right. That's part of the lack of education. If people knew to bring us in from the get-go, then we would never be brought in simply to fix a problem.
Yes.
And the actor would be safe from the very beginning. Well, I actually please go ahead.
No, I was just going to prompt you to fill in what we might have been leaving out.
Well, I actually wanted to ask you, Paul, because I've been wanting to pick your brain about your experience as a voice coach in the theater. What have your experiences been with sound designers and being part of the production team?
Almost no contact, as you have pointed out. If anything, it's a combative relationship. when the sound designer is pumping up the amplification, I'm saying, no, let's leave it to me. I'll fix that. We'll get some projection going. And of course, projection is nothing to do with being loud. It's always to do with those final consonants and the muscularity of the consonants. I said, I can make that cinematic intimacy that you're wanting. I can make that happen. But as you say, we rehearse in small spaces, and it's only in the last week, just before your opening, that you discover how inadequate the actors are in their techniques. And there's almost no time to fix things at that point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a combative, contentious relationship between the voice coach and the designer. I've never had the happy collaboration that you reported with your designer on Mackinac.
How about your experience with directors? Historically, have they been largely very happy to have you on board and your input in the room? Have they been skeptical of you? Because I know that can be contentious, because directors don't quite know what we can and cannot do in a production, and they often think we're going to take their job.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I've had some of that. I've had to learn the hard way how far to go. Because there's a relationship between dialect and acting. You can't talk about dialect without thinking about acting. And,
right.
You can get dangerously close to usurping the director's prerogative. And I've done that once or twice and learned the hard way not mm-hmm. to do that, or how to navigate that that boundary. But for the most part, of course, since my specialty is at the top of the tree, which is dialect. I'm brought in mostly thought of as the dialect coach, with the voice coach as sort of a secondary role. Mm-hmm. They're obviously very, very happy to have me as the dialect coach, as long as it doesn't impinge on the clarity. So, which is why directors usually say, we just want a hint of the accent. We just want a hint of the dialect. And they're speaking from fear there that me imposing an exotic, hard to understand accent is going to leave the audience bemused and bewildered.
Right.
Anything else we're leaving out?
Well, I wanted to encourage for anybody who feels fired up by this conversation and wants to be part of this ongoing research and exploration, especially if you are part of the Voice and Speech Trainers Association, or if you would like to be, there is an interest group that is currently having this conversation right now. So for context, for those who don't know, within VASTA, there are four interest groups. You have EduCore, which is for educators, sort of an academia, BizCore, which is for executive coaches and independent business owners. You have HealthCore, which is for vocal health and the sort of clinical side of vocal technique training, healthcare. And then you have ArtsCore, which is largely for people who work in theater and film as voice and dialect coaches. And it's ArtsCore that is having the conversation right now. So there is a group, sort of a planning committee, who are organizing gatherings and also developing a new, you might call it an article. It is a sort of collection of ideas for how one can use a voice coach now. And the audience is meant to be largely for directors. So if it is of interest to anybody to be part of this real-time conversation, ArtsCore, the interest group in the Voice and Speech Trainers Association, is the place to be.
Amen. Amen. Great conversation. Thank you again for that long overdue article, Sarah. And thanks for joining Cameron and me.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's been an absolute delight. And to be with you, Cameron.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Cameron. And thanks to you for joining Cameron and me, Paul Meyer, and our guest, Sarah Nichols. We talked a bit about VASTA, the Voice and Speech Trainers Association, on this month's episode. This is a reminder that the annual conference will be in October in New Orleans, and Paul Meyer Dialect Services and IDEA are proud to be sponsors. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and Instagram, and me on X or Twitter at DialectPaul. Email me with your comments and questions, paul@paulmeyer.com. I end this podcast with some big news. I'll be taking a hiatus from my monthly schedule. Next month's episode, which will be a sort of greatest hits retrospective, will be my last for 2025. But fear not, we'll be back in 2026. In the meantime, Subscribe to the podcast and the PMDS mailing list to stay up to date. Join me for that fascinating retrospective next time on In a Manner of Speaking.